Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, now both the House and the Senate have taken action on legislation that will require addressing genetic engineering. It's not exactly what anybody liked. I mean, it was something that one side wanted to be more simple, one side wanted it to be voluntary. So in a typical political process, it's a compromise. And that compromise has now been voted on and has been sent to the president for his signature. And it's interesting because in this whole discussion that's gone on for some time about genetic engineering, just before all this started happening in the House and the Senate, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Now, when I say there's an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, you may assume that it was against labeling, but in fact, it was different than that. The editorial was titled "Stand Up for GMO Foods by Labeling Them. A sticker on genetically modified groceries may debunk irrational fears." And it was by Dr. Richard Sexton and Dr. Stephen Sexton. Rich Sexton is with UC Davis, and his son Stephen is an economist as well. He's with Duke University. And they had this editorial, and they go on to say that with this recent release of another exhaustive report by the National Academies of Science attesting to the safety of genetic modified organisms, or GMOs, it is time for the food industry and advocates of genetically engineered crops to stand up for their products and put a label on them. And then they go on to say this could be the best way to make consumers confront their irrational fears, to stamp out public ignorance, and to save an important technology that is too easily demonized by some companies. Well, it was an interesting point, and in fact, I got a hold of Dr. Sexton, and Rich, it looks to me like you might have started breaking the logjam here, because soon after you came out with the editorial saying companies ought to just get over it and stand up for GMO foods and label them, in fact, the Senate did act, and the House has acted, and it looks like the logjam has broken.
Well, I think two things, and first of all, I appreciate you laying it out there that we might have credit for or take credit for breaking the logjam, but I don't think we can do that. I think the slowly as things move in the political process, the move forward within a couple of days of our op-ed appearing makes it, to my mind, pretty unlikely that we were a motivating factor. But the rationale, I think, was really twofold. Well, first of all, there's a way greater GMO presence already in the food system than most people realize. So everyone, I think, is consuming products that contain GMOs, and nobody's getting sick as a consequence of it. And and secondly, is just the high level of frankly, consumer ignorance and misunderstanding about the roles that GMOs play in the food system, and the idea that if we just go ahead and get the information out there, it'll soon enough be much ado about nothing.
So again, kind of backing up, you're saying the industry ought to just go ahead and do it, and go ahead and say that it contains GMO. And then what? Fill in with a lot more consumer education so people better understand what that means exactly?
Well, I think even the labeling will provide a lot of consumer education, because people will start to realize that a lot of the things they routinely consume contains GMOs. So anything, any product that is sweetened with beet sugar or high fructose corn syrup is those in this country are both GMO products, and so that's just one example where a wide range of food products that obviously have those types of sweeteners then are GMO products. And so various estimates, and we cite those in the Wall Street Journal piece, suggest that about 70 or so percent of food products on the shelves now actually contain GMOs, and so the idea is not is to let people see that it's not some, you know, scary Frankenfood thing. It's just part of the natural evolution of the food system, and it's a way to, you know, frankly make our agriculture more productive and you know, less environmentally taxing. So it's you know, it's an unmitigated positive factor, and the sooner people understand that, I think the better off we're all going to be.
Well, one thing I think it's good to point out, too, though, is that of, what, 320-some products, food products that we grow, the commodities that we grow, there's only a handful yet that handful goes into a lot of processed products. So, you know, the corn and the soybeans and soybean meal and some of the other products that are in there. So a large part of when you say that over 70% of what we consume contains GMO, those are processed somehow. They're crackers and cookies and all the foods that we eat, but not necessarily many of the fresh fruits and vegetables.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, yeah. It's a comparatively few food products that have GMOs today, and there's quite a bit of misinformation on that as well, including a letter to the editor in the journal following our piece, wherein you know, somebody wrote in and it implied that the peaches he was getting at the grocery store were GMO, and there's no GMO peaches. So, you know, you're absolutely right that that the majority of raw agricultural products coming off the farm don't have are not GMO products, but it's, you know, going through that processing system that you know, if sweeteners are added and so forth, that GMO products become introduced. And you know, frankly, it's you know, the investment that's required to, you know, bring these products to the marketplace is, you know, companies are reluctant to make that investment when there's this consumer backlash. So one of the reasons there's as few products as there are is, you know, is this consumer misinformation. And then in parts of the world, for example, Europe, you know, they're essentially banned. So there probably would be and will be more of those types of adaptations if the public comes to have a you know, more acceptance of those types of products. And if I can just offer one kind of quick example, Roger, is, I mean, as I'm sure you know, a huge problem in the citrus industry is citrus greening. I mean, it threatens the viability of whole industries. And you know, one solution would be that the scientists are working on. It would be to introduce a genetically modified element into the production process that would supposedly attack the citrus greening. And I mean, I'm not an expert on the science, but I was called into play, so to speak, by a research team at Davis that was working on this to basically ask the question, you know, would consumers accept this product given that it would have a genetic modification? So there's an example where there's a you know, hugely significant and serious concern that could be addressed by introducing a GMO into the process, and basically we're afraid to do it.
Well, you know, what's interesting on that example is that's one where Michael Pollan was in an interview, and he pointed out that this may well be a perfect place to be applying genetic engineering. And most people might have been surprised, but he's acknowledged that there can be a time and a place and somewhere that's the only way to go forward, and this might be the case with the citrus greening. You know, one more thing about the how we refer to it, Rich. You know, in the proposals that have been going through lately, they don't refer to GMO. They talk about saying, you know, identifying it as being genetically engineered, do you think that makes any difference that the terminology is kind of shifting from just GMO to possibly something like contains genetically engineered food?
That's a good point, and I don't have an answer to that, Roger. I think that's something that it would be pretty easily tested with types of market experiments that economists do routinely. So I don't know if people have looked into that or not. But I think anything that sort of quells some of the fears and the concerns can be a good thing, and that's, you know, that comes back to our fundamental point that if really consumers start to understand a little bit better the pervasiveness of GMOs within the food system, and then frankly the beneficial aspects that they bring in many cases, I think we can quickly move to greater acceptance and appreciation of their role in the food system.
Well, you know, as a result of all that's been going on in this last year, and especially including the Vermont law passing and other states looking at this, now there's at the federal level, instead of just voluntary, we're just kind of on the verge of getting in these approaches that would be mandatory. They have like three choices, it looks like. It looks like that they might be able to put right on the package something like, genetically engineered. Or they may be able to put a QR code or some other way to go to other data that might be available on the label itself. Or apparently there's a third area. The USDA might just create a symbol that is descriptive of whether or not it includes genetically engineered, and that might take a while. Do you have any thoughts on these different avenues of the information being provided?
I think any can work. Steve's and my point was that we should just get it out there. Let's not hide it behind something that people have to go to some significant effort to figure it out. And the thing that we can't have, Roger, is the state of affairs now with a single state, a small state, putting in place a labeling requirement, and then possibly other states putting in their own, albeit different, labeling requirements, so that it cries out for uniformity. And so, I mean, it's a good thing that our federal legislators are getting involved, because I consult with some processed food makers, and they were basically saying that, okay, well, Vermont is going to effectively set the standard for the rest of the country, because they can't, their distribution systems and so forth just don't accommodate having different labels and so forth for product that's going to one state versus another. I mean, the nature of interstate commerce just doesn't work that way. So we can't have the whims of individual state legislators for who knows whatever reasons effectively setting national policy, which unless and until the federal government steps in, the legislators in Vermont were going to effectively end up doing. So there has to be uniformity, and then the federal standards have to preempt and preclude individual states messing with it, or our ability to market food just is made dramatically more difficult. So my personal view is get the information out there, but the key thing is to have uniform federal standards and get the states out of the process.
Yeah, because I've always already hearing stories, and I'm not able to vouch for them, but that some products aren't coming into Vermont already. Because the manufacturer knows they're not going to be able to meet the deadline and meet the requirement, and Vermont shoppers might have to go to Maine or New Hampshire or Massachusetts or New York or somewhere and buy some products, which sounds pretty far-fetched. But I think your point is excellent, that it just is an example that all over the country it'd just be chaos.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think the food manufacturer's choice, more or less, is to adopt the Vermont label. And of course, the uncertainty of what's going on at the federal level has played a key role there, in terms of, are the feds going to come in and do something that preempts Vermont, or are they not? And is the Vermont label going to take effect? Because, so you either, as things stand currently, you're either going to do Vermont and do it, do that label widespread, or to stay out of Vermont.
It's interesting. I mean, the organic industry, apparently most of the people involved in that, the organizations and companies, are much happier with the federal proposal than they were with the Vermont law. Apparently they had some issues with the Vermont law. So they're just it's quite a dynamic time. Now, it gets back to one more thing I want to circle back on, Rich, and that is the need and how much misunderstanding there is. I mean, you've pointed out in that article that there's a lot of evidence that showing up that many consumers, if not most consumers, are concerned and say they want to know whether or not something contains GMO. And many of them, according, I think, to Pew Research, or maybe most of them, thought GMOs may be unsafe. And yet you also point out that a study showed almost 88% of scientists saw no issues and no reason for concern. So there's a huge gap there between the science and the consumers. How are we going to bridge that gap? I mean, if you put the information on, even if you said it's genetically engineered, how are we going to do a better job of having consumers know what that in fact means?
Well, I mean, that's a very good point. A lot of the survey evidence indicates really conflicting views held by consumers, and there just is a whole lot of misinformation out there, and which comes back to Steve's and my point that maybe just getting the facts out there on the labels is at least a big first step to educating consumers. But we have to do a better job of that. We have to make people understand that some of these genetically engineered traits enable us to use way less toxic herbicides and pesticides that enable us to, the new generation of GMOs is going to enable us to produce more nutrient dense foods, produce increase yields, which is then going to reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture. And a point we made, Roger, that we haven't really talked about yet, that I think is fundamentally important, is that by 2050, depending on which estimate you follow, we have to increase food production by 70% to 100%. And I personally am more inclined towards the 100% estimate, because it reflects sort of the changes in diets that we see happening in high population places such as China and India, and we're really not on pace to do it. Productivity has agricultural productivity has slowed down in recent years, which is something my colleague Julian Alston has documented. And if we consistently put the brakes on technologies such as genetic engineering that will enable us to increase productivity, we're going to be in trouble in terms of being able to feed a growing population, and a population that's also growing in wealth and wants to eat more and better foods, proteins, fruits and vegetables, instead of just a few basic staple commodities. And so, I don't think people look at the big picture when they say, "Ooh, GMOs." I don't want to eat GMOs. But those attitudes held in developing countries like the U.S. and the EU then more or less curtail the development of those types of products that are probably essential for our ability to feed ourselves as we move into the future.
Well, it is a complicated picture, too. And certainly with the big row crops and the large commodities that are producing staples, the staple foods, as we've referred to them in the past, they're going to have something like maybe genetic engineering and so forth to do it. But there's also a bunch of commodities that have done a really good job and had huge increases just using other kinds of hybrid technologies, or in the case of some of the products here in California, we've got more efficient with water and drip irrigation, and some of the commodities have had 25-30% increase in yields without doing anything different genetically. So there's progress. I just wanted to point out that there continues to be progress on lots of fronts. It's not going to be just genetics that are going to have to be used to be able to make sure we're moving ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, and that needs to be our approach, is that things that can enable us to increase efficiency without damaging the environment, or in many cases, it's a win-win, right? You know, mm-hmm. things like with irrigation, improved irrigation technologies, or GMOs, we can improve yields, we can improve the quality of the products we're producing, and we can do it in a way that's actually beneficial to the environment. And so, yeah, the message of Julian Alston and his colleagues is that we need these things. So, yeah, there are some amazing success stories out there, as you note, but then when you take a step back and look at the big picture, agricultural productivity growth in this country has slowed dramatically from the pace that it was doing, for example, in the middle part of the 20th century. And so we need not to be tying agriculture's hands as populations grow and become wealthier and want to eat more and better foods.
Well, Rich, this is excellent. I really appreciate this. And I think we're going to have more conversations like this, because this whole process is opening up a portal, I think, to provide more information to consumers. And they say they want to know everything there is to know about how their food is produced. So welcome to the new world. They can have at it. And having at it, one final question for you, Rich. Is there some place that people want to look at work done at UC Davis or the whole UC system or science that's easy for the layman to people that want to dig in a little deeper and understand more about these issues? Is there any kind of one-stop shopping, or do they just Google the subjects and take their chances?
Well, Googling works pretty darn well, but something I would recommend to your listeners is a bi-monthly publication that the Giannini Foundation, the UC Giannini Foundation, puts out, and it's basically produced by my department at Davis and our sister department at Berkeley, and it's called the Agricultural and Resource Economics Update, and so comes out bi-monthly, usually three or four articles, short, intended for a lay audience. And people can get to that by going to the Giannini Foundation's website, my department's website. So that's easy to find and bookmark if people want to. And, it comes out every other month. And good stuff on a wide variety of issues, including the types of things we're talking about today.
Well, Rich Sexton, UC Davis, thank you very much. I appreciate your being here on a guest today on Farm to Table Talk. And I think you're being too modest. I really do think you've helped contribute to this whole conversation, and you'll continue to contribute. Now we're going into a period of time again where not only GMO labeling, but a wide range of areas has let me understand more about how my food is produced. And no doubt UC Davis and your group will be playing a role in helping that conversation along. So, Rich, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
My pleasure, Roger.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.